KFMB. San Diego's talk radio leader, 760 KFMB presents It's Your Money, Not Theirs. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future. Now, It's Your Money, Not Theirs on Talk Radio 760 KFMB.
All right, good evening, everybody. My name is Joe Vecchio, your co-host, announcer, and producer. We are live from KFMB studios in lovely Kearny Mesa. Broadcasting with 50,000 watts of power, reaching not just San Diego County, but Orange County, Los Angeles County, up to Seattle on a good night. And now it's time to introduce my co-host, who's a marathon runner, an accomplished family office advisor, core member of STAR, San Diego Strategic Trusted Advisors Roundtable, terrific family man and all-around good guy, CPA Richard Muzio. Richard, good evening. How are you tonight?
I'm doing great, Joe. I just got back from the tennis tournament.
La Costa,
where Domenica Sabolkova, number 14 in the world, won her second tournament ever. So that was fun stuff.
Wow.
Very exciting.
Wow. Straight sets or was it?
Yeah, straight sets. She won the first set 6-1, then trailing 4-1 in the second. She rolled another 6-1 to win 7-5 against Marion Bartoli, number 10 in the world. Fun stuff.
Yeah. And Padres win today.
Yeah, and I brought you a gift, though, from La Costa, Joe.
You did.
And it makes noise. And it's real cute, and it's continuing the theme of the show from 2 weeks ago. So here, Joe, catch.
Oh, my God, look at
that. Joe gets his own cat in the hat.
This is a cat. Well, look at that.
And it's a cat in the hat that actually is an action figure, so you can bang the hands together and clap, or you can squeeze the feet, and it makes a noise.
Oh, excellent. Well, thank
you. And
it
has a mirror in the middle, Joe, but since you have a face made for radio, you may not want to use that.
Oh, my God. You know what? It's a carnival mirror.
It's a carnival mirror. Exactly.
Well, thank you very much.
So now you have your own cat in the hat.
I will cherish that and keep that with my pictures from our terrific day at the La Valencia when we unveiled the plaque for Dr. Seuss a couple of weeks ago. And
But I was thinking of you because I saw the newspaper article in the Union earlier this week about the event.
Yes, Diane Bell did a very
Diane Bell
nice
did a great job. Article.
I appreciate her coverage on that. It was very nice. But anyway, yeah, get up to the La Valencia and get into the Whaling Bar. And booth number 3 was his favorite booth. You can sit there and read the plaque and get some of that Dr. Seuss creative genius magic next time you're up there. So anyway, having beautiful weather, unlike the rest of the country, who's sweltering heat and drought and everything else, and we're somehow surviving, Richard. So how was your weekend? What else did you do besides
that? That was pretty much it.
Pretty much it?
Yeah, hang out and watch some tennis.
Wonderful.
Yeah. And we have a creative genius on the show tonight, too.
Just
a different one.
I heard that. You know, we've had quite a flurry of great guests, and we're keeping that tradition. We had, Frank Partner last week, noted national expert on Wall Street. Prior to that, Dick Enberg, sportscasting legend. On and on and on. And then tonight, why don't you go ahead and introduce tonight's guest?
That would be Mr. Gene Locklear. And Gene was, he was known on two fronts. He is a Native American artist who, in his previous life, so to speak, was a Major League Baseball player. And he was a really good hitter, too. So,
and a full-blooded Native American.
A Lumbee Indian, correct, Gene? North Carolina.
This is true. Lumbee, yep.
Lumbee. Right. And so, played Major League Baseball, was a teammate of Pete Rose's, and then over here in San Diego with the great Dave Winfield, and has since gone on to even more fame with the art that he creates. So, Gene, welcome. Thanks for coming out tonight.
Welcome.
Appreciate you guys having me now.
Yeah. Hey, now you were born where? North Carolina. And how does a young Native American from North Carolina get into baseball? I mean, was that part of the program back then, or?
Well, if you believe in the creator above, that's the only way I can explain it, is because a lot of luck, being at the right place at the right time, and if you do believe in God and that's what's happened, because if you look at my history, a lot of things had to fall in place for me to be here today just talking with you guys about some of the things I have done.
And Gene was no ordinary player, Joe. Lifetime batting average is .274. And in the 74 season, he hit .321 in 100 games. So that wasn't one of those 8-for-25 kind of .320s. That was a .321 in 100 games here with the Padres. And I remember Gene primarily in left field. Maybe you played the other outfield positions too, but for whatever reason, I remember you in left field. But traded over from the Reds fairly early in your career, right?
Traded in 1973 for Freddie Norman, left-hand pitcher. In fact, probably the best pitcher the Padres had at the time.
Wow.
Yeah, I remember him with the screwball.
Yeah.
He won a couple of rings with the Reds then later in their starting rotation.
One of the reasons he was traded over there, guys, he ended up before that, every time he'd pitch against Cincinnati, he'd end up pitching a shutout. So they said, we got to end that. So they,
trade for
they gave the Padres some money and me.
That's good. But you know, how did you come to find baseball? I mean, it must have been when you were in school, when you were a child?
Not really. We didn't have any Little League, Babe Ruth, or any of that. You know, all the men, you might say, farmers, most of them, and on the weekend, Saturday and Sunday, that was the daily thing to do on the weekend. You go fishing or play baseball. So I ended up having cousins and whatever in the neighborhood that taught me at a very young age how to play the game. And by the time I was 10, 12 years old, I was playing, what you might say, were grown men. And then by the time I did sign at 18, I never played rookie ball because I was already advanced, and I started playing 1A. Three years later, I'm in the big leagues.
So you grew up in a very rural community? Your parents were poor then? Is that right?
Very poor. If you think about Native Americans at that period of time, and if you go down to Robeson County, where I'm from, and the Native Americans, 80-90% of them was farmers.
Is that still the case today?
No, very educated. We're a very educated group of Americans, Native Americans now, probably the most educated in the United States now. We have, in fact, we have like 15 banks that's owned and run by Native Americans.
Wow.
We were one of the first Native American groups to have our own university. We have lawyers and judges and you name it. We own our own businesses. In fact, in Robeson County, in the school system, on the board, 8 out of the 10 people that sit on the education board in Robeson County is Native American.
Now, how do you account for that? Why? Obviously, you got a little more advancement than other sectors in there.
We're not owned by the BIA, and when I say owned, that's exactly what it is. If you're raised or you live on a reservation, you are owned by the BIA, which means
Bureau of Indian Affairs.
You don't own anything. They loan you the land you live on. They send you canned food and take care of your rent on your homes and. That's it. And then you're limited to as far as the ambitions of when you're young and freedom. There's no freedom. Mm-hmm. Again, when somebody owns you, there's no freedom.
But let me ask you a question. We'll talk about Native Americans before we go on to art. The phenomenon here on the West Coast of Indian tribes owning casinos so that almost everybody in the tribe is a millionaire. Has that solved any problems, or is that better than, for example, what the BIA has done, or is that just another form of control?
I don't really think the BIA is too happy with the Native Americans having too many casinos because, again, that does make them a little more independent of the BIA or the government. So they're not really too happy with that. And then when you think about it, the funding, what happens is if a tribe ends up with a casino and they make a certain amount of money, then the government don't have to then give them a certain amount of money.
Right.
So then what happens with the BIA then? Of course, that eliminates some jobs when you don't have to give out. I mean, there's a whole
series of events
there that happens when the casinos do come involved. And I do think that people that work for the BIA and when you talk about politics and all that would really not really love to see the independence of the Native American, because that cuts out jobs, that cuts out certain money coming your way and all the other things.
And interesting.
Did you have casinos in your area?
No. If you're not owned by the BIA, or if you're not registered with the BIA, you have the freedom just like any other American. Now, we decided back in 1930s and 40s that we did not want to be under the BIA.
Okay.
And so by having that decision gave us the freedom then to own our own school systems. For instance, when I went to high school and grammar school, it was all Native American school.
This is North Carolina.
Yes, because we have a big population, about 60,000 strong.
Okay.
So there was 4 schools in Robeson County. It was all Native American. Then you had your black schools and your white schools. So we chose our forefathers was intelligent enough to know that education was the secret. Mm-hmm. So with education, we could get ourselves out of the hole, which we've done, and not be dependent upon the government and not being owned by the government. And so that's why we are what we are today. And those who are living on reservations are still living the same way they did most of them 100 years ago. They're still in the same situation.
So let me ask you another question with regard to this West Coast phenomenon of casinos and the comment, I truly believe that education is the way to improve lives. When people have a very successful casino so that almost everybody in the tribe is independently wealthy and doesn't have to work, whether they're educated or not, do you think that's healthy for cultures, whether that's Native American cultures or any culture in general?
Let me say this. It hasn't been, I think, for the last few years, but it is changing. When I say it's changing, the tribes are beginning to realize that when you just give someone money without having ways
to earn
accountability
it.
Of that money, then that doesn't solve any problems. That only makes the problem worse. So now what a lot of them is doing is saying you have to have a high school education. And then, you know, incentive is if you'll go to college and get a college education, we'll even give you more. Mm-hmm. But now if you don't do any of this, then you're going to be limited as far as the funding you get and the situation then that you fit into the tribe. Mm-hmm. So they are learning. And also another thing they're doing is they're getting financial advice, which is a very important when you think about it. When you think about a people that has never had the financial ability of handling money. Mm-hmm. Then what do you do? I mean, if somebody gives you $100,000, that's $100,000. And if you don't know what to do with it financially as far as an investment, how to spend it, how much to spend it, what to do with it, then most likely, and I do know this happens at the end of the year, the $100,000 is gone and you say, what happened to that money?
It may even be gone before the end of the year.
Yeah. So yeah. Now they are learning to take financial help from people that send that and say, hey, we want you to now come in and financially help our people, teach them how to now take our money in investment. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the year, and they can show their kids and everybody else what's good.
And they can always call our show if they want good investment advice. Right.
Anyway, or go on iymoney.com. Hey, we have to take a short break, and we'll be right back after these short announcements. Stay tuned. All right, we are back with more of It's Your Money, Not Theirs with Gene Locklear, former Padre and Yankee and all around and other teams as well, Native American artist, and Richard Musso and myself. So welcome back, gents. What do we want to talk about first, Richard?
Joe, quick question. I want to thank our major sponsor, UBS, and Drew Freitas and Mike Coranta and Michael Kanner. But did you remember to bring my books tonight, Joe?
Oh, I do have your books.
Okay, good. Don't forget to give me my books. Joe got
books.
Some books signed by Mrs. Geisel, the better half of the late Dr. Seuss. So yes. Thanks for doing that.
Yes.
So, Gene, talking about baseball, talking about Native Americans and culture, you now do some traveling to actually go to reservations to, well, I guess you'd call them do baseball clinics. What is that all about? Why do you do that, and what happens there?
Well, I have a theory, which is if I'm beginning to go forward on, which is, for instance, I'll be in Nevada from Tuesday to Sunday, and then I come in for one day, and then I leave for San Francisco for 7 days to work on two different reservations with their kids. Now, a lot of times, like for instance, the one in Nevada is a small reservation, actually about 3 hours outside of Las Vegas. They don't even have a baseball field.
Oh, wow.
Now, the bad thing about that is then you run into kids that's 10 and 12 years old that's never played baseball. Mm-hmm. And that's supposed to be the American game. Mm-hmm. Now, is it because they're so poor, or is it because of the situation of the education there? What is the reason? Well, there's a lot of different reasons. There's, for instance, one of the things that I really want to do is I want to go into a lot of reservations that has, for instance, has casinos, that has the money to then go out and promote sports for the kids. And then I want to educate Native American kids to go work with other Native American kids, for instance, on reservations that do not have the wealth, do not have casinos, do not have an education system with coaches and whatever to work with them. But yet, I think there's a way of educating Native American kids that have that ability then and let them go work with the other kids that don't have the same opportunity. Mm-hmm. That's what I'd love to see happen.
Yeah, and I think baseball is probably, of all the sports, the best sports for teaching life's lessons. I'm not quite sure how else to put that, because it's a collaborative game. It's an individual sport played in a team setting. And so therefore, it's much more, well, it's unique compared to pure team sports like basketball and football. I know there was a long history in the major leagues of some great Indian players. Jim Thorpe, of course, the great Olympic athlete from Carlisle University.
Well, how many did
now,
play?
Let's go back that 1 minute. If Jim Thorpe would have never went to school, if his dad had not have forced him into school education, would we have ever known who Jim Thorpe is?
I doubt it. I'm not sure how we would have, because he never would have been found.
That's the whole key. Yeah, so right. What I'm saying is one of the things that I think is being missed right now is the tribes that have the money to put into sports systems to work with kids, and not been taking that and going to tribes that don't have money, don't have an education system again, and don't even have a coach on the tribe to go out and work with kids. There's no reason why there shouldn't be a system already in place for that.
And then you mentioned before the break or during the break that there's 250 tribes. Is that
approximately,
in today's world?
Yes.
Wow, that's
you mean in the United States today's world, right?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. who'd have thunk that?
And here's the. One of the things with that is if you go back in history, they speak a different language. Mm-hmm. When you say, why does the tribes and why is there not more unity between Native Americans? Well, they have a whole different language. They have a whole different way of living. When you go from the East Coast to the West Coast, their way of thinking, the way they live, what they eat, how they live every day, and what they everything is different from one tribe to the other. So it's like if you took a tribe here and went to North Carolina, what would they have in common? So then it's very hard then to unite these people, to get them together in one group, not like maybe the black man or like the Jews or someone else of a different nationality. The Indian has a whole nother problem within itself as far as communication.
Well, I think you could say it about Italy, for gosh. I mean, the people in the north can't even understand the people in the south, so yeah. there is that challenge. But, you know, as the world gets smaller and with all this high tech and everything else, hopefully that'll bring people closer together and be able to communicate better. So
I have a great quote from the 1912 Olympics. King Gustav V of Sweden, speaking to Jim Thorpe, said, "You, sir, are the greatest athlete in the world." And I think that's now inscribed on Jim Thorpe's. It's not a grave, whatever those.
Okay, where is Jim Thorpe buried? Where is his body? Where does his body lie?
Oklahoma. You know that I don't know.
Oklahoma, I don't know. I'll take a guess.
That I don't know.
Okay, Jim Thorpe's body is in Pennsylvania.
I know he's from Pennsylvania. Okay.
So you see, let's go back here a little bit. We don't have enough time to talk about this, but Jim Thorpe's own people sold his body.
Wow, I didn't know that.
They sold him and his rights to him to a university in Pennsylvania, and now that's where his body lies. So that's another thing we could get into, and we don't have time, is the individual willpower of the Native American's way of thinking about himself. Where does he fit into America? See, that one thing can say that the Native Americans a lot of times do not feel that they're our Americans. And when you kill a man's dreams, and when you take away everything he's ever known that makes him the human being that he is, that gives him pride and the will to live, then what do you have left?
Right.
Well, I guess we did apologize to him and his family at some point in time. I think didn't Richard Nixon in 73, they had a Jim Thorpe Day and gave his medals back and all that.
The family got the medals back. I forget medals. All of the details.
Wow. We'll get more into this history when we come back after this short break. More Vic's Money Not Theirs. Please stay tuned. We're back with more of Risk Your Money Not Theirs with Joe Vecchio, Richard Musio, and our guest Gene Locklear, Major League Baseball player with the Yankees, Reds, Padres, and Native American artist and all that good stuff. So welcome back, gentlemen.
Thanks, Joe. I'm going to thank the sponsors, UBS, again, thank you, and our other sponsors. Not that they're just other sponsors. They mean a lot to us. Business Valuations Limited and Carl Sheeler, Sean Puckett and Steve Sefton at Regents Bank. Don Epic and Paul Polito, CPAs at Polito Epic & Associates. Family Legacy Legal with Mr. Rich Gaines. And, of course, Jason Kruger at Signature Analytics. And also another big thank you to La Valencia Hotel for the big event 2 weeks ago with the Dr. Seuss plaque unveiling. So thank you.
It was great having them there, and it was great having the dinner. It was just a terrific day.
It was neat stuff. So anyway, so Gene, back to baseball. I want to transition to art, but back to baseball. We had the Padres' first announcer ever on the show recently, Mr. Jerry Gross, and he had some funny Buzzy Bavese stories. Do you have any Buzzy Bavese stories you can tell, but on the air? Because we got children listening to the show, okay?
Sure, you got your finger on that switch there.
Let's see, let me start out with, I got in trouble with Buzzy the first year in 73. I had an accident coming to the ballpark. I missed the bus. I had to buy my own plane ticket to go to L.A. It just happened to be a short flight. I was promised they would repay me my ticket when I got back. When I got back, they said, "We don't owe you anything. We're not paying you anything." And literally, that's what they said. If you want your money, which was only $60, if you want your money, you call Buzzy.
Okay.
So I called Buzzy. Buzzy, I said, and it wasn't the money. It was the personal thing.
Now, he's the president of the team? Or is
okay. It's a personal thing now. It's not a matter of $60.
It's that you told me something
and you fooled me. You made a fool out of me. You made me buy my own plane ticket. See, and now you're not going to pay me back, right? So I called Buzzy, and I go, "Buzzy, you know, you owe me so..." "What do you mean I owe you?" I said, "Promise me we're not going to give you any money for..." And then went off, and I hung the phone up.
Okay.
From that day forward...
Uh-huh.
2 weeks later, I'm in the batter's box. I'm being booed, right? And I did a certain thing that wasn't very nice. And guess what? Buzzy was sitting in his box, and he had binoculars. So the next day when I get to the ballpark, someone said, "You got to call Buzzy." And I'm going, "Oh, my God." So I call Buzzy. I go, "Yeah, Buzz." He goes, "Tell me I didn't see what I think I saw last night." And I said, "What was that, Buzzy?" "Tell me I didn't see you do certain things with the finger." And I said, "Buzzy, I would never do that. I'm not that kind of man." I said, "Buzzy, you cannot see that far from the box." He said, "I had my binoculars on you. I saw you." I said, "Buzzy, well, here's what I was doing, Buzzy." And I'm thinking real quick, right? I said, "Buzzy, I was fixing the helmet on my head. That's why you saw my finger probably just popped up." I said, "Buzzy, I'll take that explanation," right? That wasn't the end of it. He was still peed off. So later, Houston comes into town. I'm in the outfield talking to one of the Houston players. So he calls down to the umpires. He goes, "Locklear's fraternizing." He's out there on the field talking to one of the Houston players. "Find him, find him."
Oh, for God's sake.
So during the game, one of the umpires come up. He goes, "Hey, Gene, I want you to know we're not going to fine you." I go, "Fine me? Fine me for what? For fraternizing. Buzzy wants us to fine you for talking to the Houston player over there." Now, that's just a couple of them, but I could go on and on and
that's
on.
Funny.
How much was the fine? Any idea?
I don't know how much it was. Probably $100
something.
You
never got the $60 back, ever?
Never did.
Never did.
Get my money.
Well, speaking of
that's funny stuff.
Who was the Padre official who was flipped off the fan?
Chubb Feeney.
Oh, okay. And then he was NL president.
Exactly. Yeah, that was Mr. Feeney who did that.
So, anyway.
But wait, Gene Locklear.
You're in good company, Gene.
Before the show, I gave Gene Locklear a copy of the box score of the last game he ever played in, which was the last game of the season in 1977 at the New York Yankees. He went 3-for-5 with 2 RBIs, played with Reggie Jackson, Pete Rose, Dave Winfield here in San Diego, some pretty amazing players. But we're running out of time here fairly soon, so I want to switch the topic from, I guess you could say Buzzy Bavese was a work of art, right?
Well, let's put it like this. He called me in his office one day. When I walked in, the whole office was black like The Godfather.
Okay.
This is a true story. So I look around and I go, "Oh my God, what am I in for now?" There was only one light, and it was a little lamp sitting on his desk.
Oh my gosh,
and I look, and he wasn't to be seen. He wasn't nowhere
like
around.
It's like the scene out of Network.
And all of a sudden, I hear this voice way out in the corner going, "Sit down, kid." Now, you have to imagine, here's a kid out of North Carolina, not only that, a Native American, right?
How old were you at the time? You're like 20.
Oh, I was only like 22 years old. "Sit down, kid," he said. And I sit down, and I'm going, "Where is he?" And I'm looking.
Yeah, I see him.
Oh, man, I'm telling you. And then he ripped me. He got into me like, "Oh." Oh, man.
That's like the scene from The Natural where the owner's sitting in that dark, dark office.
Oh, yeah.
The Natural.
Remember Network, that famous scene?
Yeah, Network.
Too? Yeah, there's another one.
So Gene, you are an amazing artist. I've been to Gene's studio in his home where he has his art on the wall. There's religious art. There's Native American art. There is sports, baseball, football, and so on art. Amazing stuff. Did you know you were going to be an artist before you knew you were going to be a baseball player, or did you know you were going to be both when you were young? Can you tell us how one followed the other, or if they all happened at the same time?
Approximately when I was 7 years old, I sort of decided at seven I wanted to be an artist because there was small contests around, and of course I was the best artist in the school and all that. So right off, when you can do something very well, then it makes you feel good.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like I knew I wanted to be an artist. And then one day I saw this college team, and the uniforms was like, oh, and I'm saying, hey, now I want to be a baseball player, right? So from that day on, if someone asked me, what did I want to be? I'd say a baseball player and an artist.
Okay.
I mean, but again, you know, it's like one of those things of you don't know any better. So I don't know what it's going to take. I had no understanding of the ability that I would have to be a professional artist and make a living at it and also be a professional baseball player and end up in the major leagues.
And can we give out your website on the air?
Sure, yeah.
Everybody, you've got to look at this, www.genelocklear.com, GENELOCKLEAR.com, genelocklear.com. Some amazing stuff up there, and you ought to see the originals. So did you do some painting then while you were playing Major League Baseball or in the off seasons or if you were playing winter ball did the art sort of sit dormant for a while?
I had to, guys. I didn't make any money. I mean, I hit .321, and the reason I was a free agent and the reason I stayed in San Diego was that I was promised by the vice president of the team that I would start the next year and I would play. And I said, okay, so I got a $10,000 raise. Now, to be honest, I knew Oakland wanted me because I'd already talked to Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
The Dodgers wanted me, but I wasn't going to play every day with the Dodgers. My whole thing was I wanted to play every day, and then when I played, I knew I'd hit 300, I'd make my money.
Mm-hmm.
So me being who I was and believed the gentleman that I was talking to, who was Peter Bavese,
mm-hmm.
I signed a contract. So, of course, you know the history. The next year, I never played another game in San Diego, and they traded me off to New York. But that's how it happened with me.
So you would support yourself in the off season and so on?
I never, after I hit .321, I made $30,000, and you think about it. If you have an apartment during the season,
mm-hmm.
If you have a car, then what I would do in the off season is I would have small shows in North Carolina. You know, I would go to banks, for instance,
mm-hmm.
And I'd have a bank to sponsor me and invite their people that was involved in the bank, would have a VIP, a one-night invitation thing. I'd hang my paintings. And that's what I would do in the off season. I did it my whole life because the only time I ever made any money is when I went to Japan in 78, and I signed a three-year contract for $300,000. That was the only time I made any money.
Huh. Did you have formal training to be an artist, or did you just...
While I was in high school, I took correspondence courses. When I finished high school, I finished art school with a commercial art degree. So right out of high school, I had a commercial art degree, and of course, a year after high school, I signed to play baseball and went on in its history. But even if I'd have stayed in North Carolina, there's no way, you know, I could have made a living out. I still had to have moved on to New York, Chicago, or somewhere to actually have made a living with my art.
I already had the training. Did you ever meet Dr. Seuss when you were here at all, or no?
No, I didn't. Two different artists.
So let me ask a couple quick baseball questions, then we're going to finish up the last quarter with art. The toughest pitcher you ever had to hit?
Tom Seaver.
Okay. A lot of break on the ball, throws hard, great control. Yeah.
You want to know why?
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 Tom Seaver, it was like a lot of pitchers today's not like, which is Tom Seaver's had two or three fastballs.
Okay.
Now, if you're a great hitter, what you do is you sit on the fastball and,
right.
you wait for the changeup, slider, off speed. Now, the way Tom Seavers would get you was he only showed you that good fastball when he had to. Third strike. And then what it do is keep you off balance. So that is the biggest offensive thing you can do to a great hitter, is you keep him off balance. Because a good hitter will sit on the fastball, especially a hitter like Tony Gwynn, Pete Rose, those guys, they would sit on the fastball and they were able to hit anything to the opposite field. Fastball, opposite field, up the middle. Change up, curveball, slider, up the middle, pull. See, that's how you stay balanced. That's how what keeps you in the middle. But Tom Seavers, when he threw you that good fastball, you saw it, but a lot of times he wouldn't throw it for a strike. So then you time it for that strike, and then the next one would be just a foot off, and he's got you in front, or he's got you. See what I'm saying, guys?
Yeah, I see.
That's what you kill a good hitter with.
So what do you think about Ted Williams? Best left-handed hitter ever?
Never saw him play, but he had the stats to prove it. You want to hear a Ted Williams story?
Yeah, give me a Ted Williams story.
Okay, I was the official number one artist for the Ted Williams card company. If you guys know about that. But his son had a card company at one time, and I was their number one artist, which means my set of cards was the set of cards that would go inside the other cards, and you had to collect the whole set of their whole collection to get a set of my cards. Most valuable set in the collection. So we did a thing in Florida, in his home in Florida, where we all went down to discuss business and the coming year and whatever and whatever. So he had me over to his house. We had a small party. So, of course, everybody's around Ted Williams and he's talking hidden. So I'm just wandering around. In fact, I was inside the house with the lady that he was staying with at the time, and she was showing me his whole collection of awards and all that, and I'm looking around the home, but everybody else is listening to Ted Williams, right? So somebody says, "Hey, Gene, Ted wants to talk to you." So I go out, and he goes, "Hey, you know what?" He said, "When I come back in my next life," see, Dad already planned this head thing.
He's frozen.
Yeah. When
frozen
I come back in my next life, he said, "I want to be a right-hand hitter." Now, here you have the best left-hand hitter ever lived, saying he wants to come back as right. I said, "Why is that, Ted?" He said, "Well, you see, my right hand, which is my dominant hand, will be closer to the ball."
Top hand, right-handed hitter.
He said, "What do you think about that?" I said, "Ted, I can't agree with you on that." He goes, "What do you mean you can't agree with me on that?" I said, "Well, Ted, think about it. You're right-handed, you hit left-handed." I said, "You're hitting with the strong part of your body. That's why you're a good power hitter."
Okay.
What's facing the pitcher? The strong part of your body. Not the weak side, the strong side. So you go into the ball with the strong side and then the weak side. Now, we all know the top hand for a left-hand hitter is only for balance.
Right.
That's the only thing you use it for. So the whole hand thing, the bottom hand is your power hand. That's what controls everything as far as the hand movement. He thinks a little bit. He goes, "You know what, kid? You might have something there." He said, "In fact, you know more about hitting than 80% of the guys that I talk to."
Well,
so later on before I left, he goes, "You know what, boy, I'd love to have managed you when I was managing." I said, "Yeah, I would love to manage me too."
Great story. Hey, we'll be right back with more of It's Your Money Not Theirs right after this short break for our last segment.
On Talk Radio 760, KFMB.
All right, we're back with the last segment of It's Your Money Not Theirs with Richard Musio and Gene Locklear and myself. Welcome back.
So, Gene, question, your art. There's different kinds. There's Native American. There's obviously sports figures and sports people in action. There's what I call religious. Did you start in a certain place, or did it all sort of come together all at once?
Well, I'm one of these guys that, in fact, I'm doing a lot of abstracts right now. I'm one of these guys that don't put myself in a box. I don't have any galleries, for instance, right now that handles my work.
Okay.
I used to have my own gallery down at Hotel Circa Town and Country, but I'm one of these guys that I like to do my thing as I grow older. You know, in other words, I have to have something to look forward to, and I have to have that high when I sit down to the easel to say, "Hey, I want to find out something new today. I want to create something new. I want something new to happen," instead of repeating myself and doing the same old, which is what a lot of guys that have galleries happens to them, because they they get into a certain technique, they get into a certain subject matter, they get into a certain whatever, and so that's what the galleries want. Mm-hmm. And so what they have to do is keep repeating themselves for the same thing so that the galleries can sell and make them money. I don't want that to happen to me, and maybe that's why I'm not making $1 million a year. So,
by the way, happy birthday. Gene's birthday was on Thursday, right?
Yeah, boy, I look good for 72.
Yeah, you're not. I looked up when you were born. You're not that old, man.
My wife tells me every day, God, you look good for your age. I know.
Well, so when I turned 50, when I turned 50, one of my friends said, Richard, don't worry, 50's like the new 30. I said, well, why does it feel like the new 70? But anyway, so what are you working on now? Abstracts or?
You know what? I'm in the process of doing some work for the Manhattan restaurant in La Jolla. You guys ever been there?
You know, we had dinner, Joe, when Empress. We stayed at
God,
La Valencia. We had dinner at Manhattan that Tuesday night. It's great.
Yeah,
I love that place.
Yeah, you have to go there. PJ's the owner.
Yeah, PJ.
Asked for PJ, and I'm in the process of doing about 12 pieces for there. I'm doing some abstracts, but I'm going to do some Frank Sinatra.
Wow.
Because they have a pianist there. A guy that plays a little jazz and piano on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And so I'm going to do some bar scene, probably a Frank Sinatra piece and maybe a musician piece and then some abstract. I'm looking forward to that. That's my next.
Manhattan is actually next to La Valencia's Whaling Bar. Yeah. Manhattan is my second favorite restaurant in La Jolla. But no, it's incredible. If you haven't been, Joe, you got to go.
Really good food. I think it's at Faye and Silverado, I think.
Faye and something. Yeah, Faye and something.
I know it's that maroon.
The ground floor of the hotel.
Empress.
I think that's it. Yeah, no, but it's really
neat. I've been there. It's been a while.
Great menu.
Valet parking. You don't even have to go to parking.
In fact, tell you a funny story about Manhattan. They had the best pizza I've ever had, okay? They no longer serve pizza because they have some really, really good chefs.
Oh, they still have pizza?
Well, it's not on the menu, James.
Okay.
So I'm telling everybody who's listening, they don't have pizza. But the point is, so many people were ordering pizza, and they have all these extremely accomplished chefs going, we're wasting our lives making pizza.
You have to try the calamari, then.
Yeah, we had the calamari. It was excellent. It was excellent. Well, that's good. You're working for Manhattan.
So
do you still do Native American pieces? Because you've got some amazing work. You showed me this one friend. I think it was called From Water to Water.
Yeah, that was a Kumeyaay piece, which had the history of the Kumeyaay, which I did for Grossmont Hospital. And what I did is there was a realistic piece at the bottom. And then in the sky, I started with water and ended with water, which, you know, is the essence of life. Mm-hmm. But in between there, it's a whole life story of how the Kumeyaay used to live and their whole way of living. So that's one of my best pieces I've ever done. And right now I'm doing some Western pieces. I'm always doing some Native American pieces for myself. And right now I have a 3x6 foot piece on my easel that eventually I'll get to that is a mountain scene of some Native Americans going across a mountain.
So do you think art's an important part of continuing any particular culture, whether that be Native American or any other culture?
As far as I'm concerned, artists are the most important human beings on Earth, because what artists do is they give you a record of time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they give you a record of time in a creative way. It's not political.
Right.
It's not a way of somebody demanding this is the way it's got to be seen. It's a creative thing, the way artists really see things.
Well, anyway, I think that's the most poignant finish we ever had on the show, Joe.
And speaking of time, we're out of it right now. But Gene Locklear, it was an absolute pleasure.
Gene, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Richard, thank you. You have a great week. Thank you, Chad Benson, our sound technician, and Dave Smith, our programming genius, and Craig Blank, your con executive. Thanks to all of them. You have a great week. We'll see you next Sunday night.
Times are tough and resources are stretched to the breaking point. If you or someone you know has a family member or friend in a skilled nursing or residential care facility, listen up. There's a way to save money. Oak Hill Residential Care provides full care that is often thousands less each month. They provide excellent care for all age-related illnesses, including dementia. As a nonprofit facility, Oak Hill Residential provides great care and the lowest cost possible. Call 760-743-8843 or visit their website at www.oakhillresidential.com. oakhillresidential.org. Also, did I mention that Oak Hill Residential never raises the cost? That's right. The rate you pay in the beginning will be the rate you pay until the end. This way, you can budget your cost from day one. Call Oak Hill Residential Care at 760-743-8843 or on the web at oakhillresidential.org and start saving money today. Remember, Oak Hill Residential, the nonprofit full care facility. 760-743-8843 or oakhillresidential.org.
We follow the story.
If you got a business, you didn't build that. Somebody else made that happen.
Then we leave the conversation.
This is the prelude to seizing those businesses.
Follow the leader.